Greetings, welcome, bienvenidos, hola, aloha, ni hao, namaste, konnichiwa, bonjour, buongiorno, sawadee karup, guten tak, ciao, wee viva, cat bang, half a day, jai janendra, salam, shalom, peace, now, go vegan, peace how, go vegan. From the left coast of the genetically mutated McNugget pharmaceutical vivisection prison killitary industrial court port nation in the cheese-covered post-constitutional bankster bankrupt corruptocracy mocracy criminocracy of the United States of Listeria, foodborne in the USA, home of Uncle Salmonella, where they sure do eat a lot of dead animal body parts, and the Wall Street-backed corporate diet of death, disease, and destruction is shoved down your throat. This is Go Vegan Radio with Bob Linden. Here we are, Labor Day, a day, you know, like holiday. Well, holidays had to be created so that people could take a day off from what they hated doing until those jobs went away, and now people are desperate for things to do that they hate doing. And to balance this hate-hate relationship, employers also hate to pay their employees and prefer slave labor when possible, which of course is the very foundation of this nation, an economy built on slavery right from the start. It hasn't ended. The slavery continues to this very day. Human slavery exists right now, and we have, I don't want to insult you, but you do finance that human slavery, by the way. Every time you order that all-you-can-eat shrimp plate, of course, we're blind to the plight of the shrimp who wind up on the plate, right? But don't realize they are living creatures born into slavery themselves and, given the death penalty, the shrimp, of course, they're only shrimp, right? Attitude of human supremacy. We are human supremacist speciesists, and you can eat as many shrimp as you want because of it. So, each individual being, the one who satisfies the human supremacist appetite, but human slavery exists related to the shrimp industry, as we've reported on this program in the past. Slave labor on the boats in Asia, near Thailand, people forced to work, not getting paid, thrown overboard if they don't work. So, all you can eat shrimp plate, there you go, human slavery. Slavery involves horrific oppression, and often death. That nightmare job where you don't get paid at all, where you have to pay. Sounds like the plight of so many other species, too. But also, it's still done to humans because we what we do to other species, including eating them. So what do we have in South America? We have deforestation, and then we have indigenous people being chased off the land into cities, into the slavery of prostitution. They're only prostitutes. They're only shrimp boat workers, right? We can be superior to other humans also. And then we deforest, clear the land, where do the people go? Into slavery-like situations. But human supremacists feel that they are entitled to their meat, dairy, fish, and eggs, and, again, they're only prostitutes, right? As long as you can have that bacon, they're only shrimp boat fishermen. So as long as you can have that shrimp cocktail, who cares? They're only, right? Everybody seems to be an only. That's the way things are laid out for us now. Trump seems to be trumpeting, they're only Mexicans. They're only Muslims, you know. And then on the Hillary side, well, you seem to be hearing, and not only hearing, but through direct action, they're only Iraqis, they're only Syrians, they're only Libyans, they're only Russians. Uh-oh, look out for that one. Rethink that, Hillary. Recharge the circuits there. Everyone's an only, right? You know, they're only Christians, they're only Palestinians, they're only Jews. Makes it easier to do things to them if they're only, right? It seems that it seems though that the only agreement amongst all of these separate, disparate onlys is that they believe that the others are only animals, the other species. Well, they're only animals, huh? I mean, you could be on the lowest rung of the ladder of human supremacy, on the lowest rung, but still take comfort in your supremacist knowledge that they are only animals. You know, at the time of World War II, the philosopher Theodor Adorno said, Auschwitz begins whenever somebody looks at a slaughterhouse and thinks they're only animals. And in the USA today, the labor that is considered unfair and oppressive at the moment is that of the slashed food worker, people employed at places like McDevil's and Murder King and Wendy's and Kills Jr. and Jack the Ripper in a Box and Taco Hell and Up Chuck E. Cheese and Skin and Snout Burger. The labor issue is that workers want a higher minimum wage. Well, nobody considers the price that cows, pigs, and chickens have to pay to be on the buns. Of the people who want that higher minimum wage, the cows, pigs, and chickens don't get a living wage. You know, they don't get a living wage. They get a dying wage. But they can't strike. They can't march. They can't unionize. The best they can do is hope that you go vegan, which is happening. Which is happening. I mean, it's in the news everywhere that. You know, it's just so many people are going vegan. I mean, I think the number of vegans in the UK is up 350% recently. It's just a strong movement everywhere, fueled by the millennials. The millennials are getting it, you know, because it's going to be their planet. And perhaps they, you know, haven't been jaded into viewing animals the way so many people have. I mean, you know, it seems that just so many jobs, maybe, you know, all so many jobs that exist today, I mean, they're just, you know, because of the modern slave labor of animal exploitation, it's really, I mean, when I think about it, it's so much of our economy is dependent upon this horrible slave labor, the horrible exploitation of animals. You know, I'm really, when I think about it, I'm seeing red. You know, I mean, I'm seeing that dollars are actually red. I believe our economy, when you think about it, is basically the laundering of money, which turns green only when washing the animal's blood from it. You know, I mean, think about it. Our entire economy is based in animal exploitation and massacre. How can I be for more jobs? Well, I could be for jobs for veganic farming, vegan foods, you know, play music, you know, do art. But really, when you think about it, how many jobs are not related to animal exploitation? I mean, everything associated with production and consumption of meat, dairy, fish, and eggs. Everything. Yeah? 9 billion land animals will die this year for the American appetite. 176 billion animals are farmed for food globally every year. Well, I guess that keeps people employed and busy, right? You know, that also keeps a lot of people employed in the health industry. When I think back on T. Colin Campbell being on this program, from Cornell University, who conducted the largest study of diet and health ever. What did he say on the show? I keep forgetting the percentage. He said it was at least 80%. He may have said 90%, but he said at least 80%, I'm sure. At least 80% of fatal degenerative disease is caused by animal protein, and not much of it. So everyone in the health industry, thank the consumption and production of meat, dairy, fish, and eggs for your job. Cardiologists, the manufacturers of dialysis machines. We have an economy based on animal use, abuse, exploitation, massacre. Whew. Is it any wonder? I'm the candidate against jobs. Well, for good jobs. Green economy. Okay. Green meaning veganic food. And of course, you know, all the then all the billions of dollars spent employing people in vivisection and animal experimentation, they never seem to find the cure, huh, to our meat, dairy, fish, and egg eating diseases, do they? But they stay employed. Animal exploitation for the economy, for everyone. Clothing, sure. Where if you wear leather and feathers and wool and silk and fur, work in the clothing store, you work, you know, in the leather factory, whatever, huh? All these jobs, how many jobs are, generated in the use of animals for entertainment, hunting. Ah, you know, I mean, I just love it when our teary-eyed, flesh and blood eating politicians go on camera and cry about gun control, right? You know, of course, they always put an asterisk. They say, oh, now, of course we don't want to infringe on people's right to blast away an innocent creature for fun. We wouldn't want to do that. That's not part of what we want here right now. So, you know, go on, do your hunting. Then we wonder why we are so screwed up as a nation. I mean, really. And then, how screwed up are we? Well, the choice we get is Hillary or Donald. Huh? So what does that say, right? Eating meat, dairy, fish, and eggs. Keep those military jobs happening. Keep all those billions of dollars for weaponry and war all happening. Tolstoy said, as long as there are slaughterhouses, there will be battlefields. And we do fight wars for resources like land and water and food, you know, which are all squandered by production and consumption of meat, dairy, fish, and eggs. So, looks like everybody's employed because of animal exploitation. It's kind of the invisible slavery. We don't think about the war on animals, all the blood, the rivers and oceans of blood. There's our economy. So, I guess if you want to write me in as the anti... I have a chance, right? I have a chance like Jill Stein, right? I'm the anti-job candidate who's for peace and will ban all meat, dairy, fish, and egg consumption. Okay? So, I guess I won't be... are Hillary and Trump, I mean, is unemployment so unkind to them that they have to look for this job? They want the job of president? You know, I mean, I mean, here they are. They have enough money, and you would think they wouldn't be seeking, you know, the worst job on the planet, or one of the worst jobs. I guess working in a slaughterhouse would have to be there, you know, be right up there. You'd think that working in a slaughterhouse would turn everyone vegan. Actually, coming up on today's program, we will be talking to Carl D. Scott, who is in New Zealand, and he actually did work in a slaughterhouse, and he actually did go vegan, and we will talk to him about that. And I should apologize, you know, as you may have noticed, since we went independent from the Genesis Communications Network, GCN, Alex Jones' network there. So that was the radio network that carried our program for a few years, and we've been on various radio networks in the 15 years that we've been broadcasting, including the Air America radio network, where this was the most progressive of any of those shows on that liberal network. But we've also been on right-wing radio stations, liberal stations, Clear Channel stations, CBS radio stations. So somehow we manage. Hard to understand why. But this weekend, I note that Labor Day weekend, no more Muscular Dystrophy Association telethon. It hasn't been on now for a couple of years. The Jerry Lewis telethon that raised $2 billion for animal experimentation still didn't find the cure. I was reading some articles about that telethon, which I'm happy is not being telecast this weekend, which started in 1956 at Carnegie Hall in New York, co-hosted by Dean Martin and Jerry Lewis. 1956, so I was 5 years old, and they held it in Carnegie Hall, where I had my high school graduation in 1969. And it said about Jerry Lewis that what he did to raise that money with the audience was just beg and scold. Beg and scold. That's what was written there. And now's a good time, since you're not distracted by the telethon and you might actually want to do something good with your money. May I beg you to make a donation to the 501c3 nonprofit Go Vegan Radio, who is committed to helping the world go vegan, the most important cause, the only cause that can save the planet, the only way to save us from climate change, the only way to save us from climate change. And imagine how the animals would feel if we were to all go vegan and get behind the cause. So, so as Jerry Lewis, he had it down, so he would beg the audience. So look, I'm begging you, okay? Make a donation now. Go to Go Vegan Radio. I beg you to find the donate button. And then, let's see, it said, so, and Jerry Lewis would also scold the audience to try to get the audience to donate. So, what do you mean? You haven't gone to Go Vegan Radio yet? You haven't found the donate button? I'm scolding. Come on. Get to it. No, I mean, go after the show. You don't have to go right now. Actually hang out with us until after the show. I'm begging you to stay with me during the show, okay? Please. What do you mean you're listening to me and you haven't gone to make the donation? You're not supposed to listen to me to when I ask you to listen to the show when it's important that you make a donation. I'm begging. I'm scolding. I did want to apologize, as you may have noticed. Since we went independent from GCN, the radio network that carried us for a few years. Stay on topic, Bobby. So we've had a few technical glitches, okay? And I think I now know the reason why. I mean, to go independent, this little low-budget nonprofit operation that just begged you to send money and scolded you if you didn't. We needed another laptop, and one was generously donated to us by Vanda and Christian. Thank you so much, which we received in the mail. And but the computer has been running a bit slowly, and we discovered it's because, there are so many yoga videos on it. There's just no space for our online broadcasting software on the laptop, and just the ability to handle it. We can't erase these yoga videos. Also, it says do not erase without using bleach bit. So I haven't used Clorox in a long time, so I apologize, we can't erase those videos. But at least it has sparked an interest in yoga on my part. I've been watching a few really good ones here. Really, really good posing. I didn't know yoga videos were so expensive. So I feel fortunate to have gotten to look at these. Well, it says top secret. But how top secret could, you know, yoga poses be, right? So I'm glad I had a chance to look at them for free. I'm going to have to tell the post office, though, that it delivered to the wrong address. And maybe I can make some copies for listeners of this show who are into yoga. I know there are many, you know. First, here, this one, one of the videos on here. Look at this here. It's Hatha Hillary's $10 million yoga plan for the Saudi royal family. Hatha Hillary's $10 million yoga plan for the Saudi royal family. Wow, $10 million. Well, the Saudi royal family can certainly afford that. I'm sure really good yoga poses are worth that, right? So let's see. What are some of the asanas here? Gosh, I almost feel guilty looking at this. It's top secret, huh? But okay, something. Okay, so let's see. Hillary's recommended yoga postures for the Saudi royals. The video shows. Okay. The basic asana is the Hatha Hillary Lotus Drone Strike pose. Ah, that looks like, interesting pose to get into. Yeah, the Hatha Hillary Lotus Drone Strike pose. That looks like a good one. And then there's a little more advanced one right after that. It's the Hatha Hillary Shoulder Stand Missile Launch pose. Ah, okay, I see. That's, and she threw in some perks for the $10 million, little bonus plan here from the merchandise department. Got some merch there for the family, a full set of cluster bomb yoga mats, and uranium-lined water bottles. Can't go wrong with them, right? Especially if you want to get a little bomb together. You know, of course, none of this makes sense unless we look at... look in the general establishment media, but here in the Daily Beast, for example, the headline is, Hillary Clinton's team lost a laptop full of her emails in the actual mail. So, a laptop containing a copy or archive of the emails on Hillary Clinton's private server was apparently lost in the postal mail, according to the FBI report released on Friday. Along with it, a thumb drive that also contained an archive of Clinton's emails. That's been lost also. It's not in the FBI's possession. The Donald Trump campaign has already called for Clinton to be locked up for her carelessness handling sensitive information. But nothing ever gets lost in the mail. I mean, why? They didn't need to worry. The missing laptop and thumb drive raise a new possibility that Clinton's emails could have been obtained by people for whom they weren't intended. Well, didn't we just go over all the yoga videos here? The links to those? Huh? So, that's pretty amazing that there you have it. Concerned with national security, she sends her laptop in the mail. It looks like they didn't get, they didn't register it, get a return receipt or whatever. And then, just to finish up with Hillary here, just because, am I in the same, I wanted to open up another page. But anyway, also released on Friday, I guess it's a holiday weekend, you're not supposed to pay attention to the news, and this becomes old news, but I do just want to, for a moment, look at what was in the Washington Post. It says, Hillary Clinton told the FBI she couldn't recall something more than 36 times, so more than 36 times she couldn't remember various questions from the FBI. It says here, in the 3 hours plus that Hillary Clinton spoke with the FBI investigators about her private email server on July 2nd, she cited more than 36 things that she could not recall. Among them were things such as specific emails that perhaps nobody could be expected to remember years later. But Clinton also said she had no recollection of several key moments when it came to her email server, including briefings on how to handle classified information and key conversations about her server. In at least one case, according to documents released by the FBI, Clinton said she could not recall every briefing she had received. She could not recall every briefing she had received after her 2012 concussion, which later led to a blood clot in her head. Clinton stated that she received no instructions or direction regarding the preservation or production of records from the State Department during the transition out of her role as Secretary of State in 2013, the report says. So she couldn't remember being briefed on how to handle all the information. That wasn't the tab I wanted to open. I'm sorry, there was just one more, but although that wasn't a bad one, I mean, right? I lost it. Okay. All right. So the other thing was that Hillary Clinton didn't know that when there was a C in the body of her emails, that meant it was classified. So I'm just not citing an article here, just remembering that. So whenever she saw a paragraph start with a C, she didn't realize that meant it was classified. What she said was that she imagined that paragraphs were being organized alphabetically. So C should have come after A and B, which didn't exist, or it might have come before D. I would imagine that if you think your mail is being organized by paragraph alphabetically, there wouldn't be so many C's, right? And there'd be at least an A and a B and a D. Your next president. Okay. All right. She wants the job, one of the worst jobs in the world. As I said, probably the other worst job would be working in a slaughterhouse. And we are going to talk to Carl D. Scott, who actually worked in a slaughterhouse and is a vegan today. So we will continue. It's Go Vegan Radio with Bob Linden at goveganradio.com, on Twitter at Go Vegan Radio, Facebook Go Vegan Radio with Bob Linden. And again, to support our program and to support our efforts organizing the World Vegan Summit and Expo and whatever else we seem to do, whatever events we put together, I'm begging you and scolding you to donate now at goveganradio.com. It's Go Vegan Radio with Bob Linden at goveganradio.com, on Twitter at Go Vegan Radio, Facebook Go Vegan Radio with Bob Linden. And I'd like to thank Vegetarian House Vegan Restaurant for its support of the program all these many years. Vegetarian House, 520 East Santa Clara Street in San Jose, 100% vegan, organic, non-GMO, an amazing menu. Check it out at vegetarianhouse.us. An incredible incredible international cuisine. You will love this restaurant. I think it's one of the best in the world. Check it out. And Vegetarian House caters. So if you're in the Bay Area, you have an event coming up, a social event, a business event, you're getting married, you want the food to be great, get in touch with Vegetarian House. A lot of people are contacting Vegetarian House to cater. Again, it's vegetarianhouse.us. And also thanks to Evolution Dog and Cat Food for support of this program and participating in the World Vegan Summit and Expo. You can get in touch with Eric Weissman. It's petfoodshop.com. Yes, dogs and cats can go vegan too. Daisy loves Evolution. Check it out, petfoodshop.com. So it's Labor Day weekend. Apparently I'm against all jobs because they either seem to exploit or kill animals or destroy the environment. So I'm your candidate who will, you know, I will produce no new jobs. Elect me on that platform. We'll see if that works, right? So, I think that, you know, some of the work out there is quite horrific, including, I mean, in my mind, I don't think anything could be worse than working in a slaughterhouse. And I would think that everybody who worked in a slaughterhouse would go vegan. And my next guest here worked in a slaughterhouse, and he is the organizer of a vegan society in Dunedin, New Zealand. Carl D. Scott is with us today. How are you today, Carl?
Hi, Bob. I'm good.
Thanks for being with us. So, tell us a bit about your background, your childhood, you know, how it was growing up in New Zealand. I mean, I know, well, pretty much everywhere we're indoctrinated into consuming animal flesh and secretions. I know that in my public school I was given a container of cow's milk every day. But, you know, what was life like for you in your childhood with your family, with work, relation to animals? What was it like in New Zealand for you?
Yeah, as you say, I think it's pretty similar in a lot of parts of the world, especially the industrialized parts. I grew up in a small rural town of about 3,000 people. It was a farming service community, so the main industry in the area was farming, and that was probably predominantly livestock farming as opposed to cropping or whatever. There were some people growing crops, but a lot of sheep farming was very big in my part of the country. Maybe some beef cattle and some dairy, but mainly sheep. And so I just grew up with it, thinking it was all completely normal. And my father was a hunter, and he worked at a slaughterhouse, and he also did pest control work. And now we had a couple of species introduced to New Zealand for their fur, and that was wallabies and possums, both from Australia. And they found New Zealand very much to their liking and bred prolifically and became a bit of a problem. And rabbits as well. So my father he worked in the industry controlling those species. My earliest childhood memory is of a dying animal. It was a duck that my father had shot, and his dog ran and brought the duck back to Dad, and it was still alive and flapping around at mine and my brother's feet. My earliest childhood memory. But my dad took me hunting with me and my brothers hunting with him. A lot of our friends were farmers. Dad worked on farms doing fencing, contracting and things. So
do you remember how you felt? How did you feel with your first childhood memory with the duck? Do you remember how you felt at the time?
I was terrified. I didn't really feel much empathy for the duck, maybe a little bit, but I was terrified. It was flapping towards me and my brother, and my father was laughing. He obviously thought it was hilarious. I thought I was going to die or something. You know, looking back at it now, it's like I feel horrible for the duck must have been pretty badly injured. But at the time, just fear. I was just terrified.
Yeah.
But, you know, I there was a lot of times I saw things, dead animals and things, when Dad went hunting and things, and I never really liked it. I don't think anyone likes it, or at least not many people. But you sort of tell yourself that it's a fact of life and it's a necessary evil, and you sort of harden up and get used to it. And then when I was 12 years old, a friend of mine at, well, we had a combined intermediate and high school, he wanted to do possum trapping for the fur industry, and I agreed to do that with him. And we did it for a while, and it was awful. We used those horrible, they're called gin traps, the steel jaw that holds onto the animal's leg. Mm-hmm. Horrible, horrible things. I detest them now. And but I thought, this is what I have to do. Harden up, Carl. This is the realities of life. And I remember killing the first possum, because I really didn't want to, but I did it anyway. And I remember one of the last ones I killed, and I won't go into detail, but it did not die quickly or easily. No, I won't go into detail. It was horrible. And after that, it was like, nah, that's it. I'm done with this. And I have talked to other hunters and people who have worked in slaughterhouses and things, mainly hunters, who have said they don't love what they do. There's a bit of a thrill and an excitement when they're just about to shoot the animal. But there's also a part of them that feels a bit sad or a bit uncomfortable about the whole thing. So I had those experiences, as a young person.
I also did you talk about those experiences with other young people? Were there others around who expressed the same thing?
I don't think I did. I don't think I talked about it being uncomfortable, because I don't think, you know, it would have been a sign of weakness to express those feelings.
And yet probably everybody feels that, and they would love to talk about it, you know, because I think all children love animals, right? And it just something gets twisted inside, and we have to just accept it, like you said, as that's the norm, right?
I think that's very true, and I wonder what would have happened if I had those conversations. Because when I finished, I told my friend I don't want to do possuming anymore. I didn't tell him it was because what had happened had sickened me, the horrible death of that one possum, or that I didn't like the cruelty aspect of it altogether. I just said, I don't want to do this anymore. And so I think you're right. I think a lot of people, if they'd had those conversations, would have found some common ground. But in a rural community like that, you're just expected to harden up and deal with it, I think.
Yeah, Dunedin would have been the first vegan community in New Zealand had everybody started talking about it, right?
That's right.
Yeah. So, so then what happened? Continue then with
sure.
You stopped. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, in my childhood, again, an interesting thing that I have reflected on, because we also went to rodeos and A&P shows, which is Agricultural and Pastoral Society farming shows, and there would be animals there, tractors and machinery and things. We went to zoos and circuses with exotic animals, and just took it all for granted. And I actually had a job. My friend's parents owned a small-scale battery farm, and me and my friend after school would clean the eggs and put them into trays. I never actually saw inside the sheds where the hens were. And I don't think that was an accident. I don't think I was supposed to see in there. I saw some wee baby chicks in the incubator. This is a big drum thing with a lid on it. And I remember thinking, this is weird. I don't like this. I have no idea what they did with the male chicks on that farm. But so also, there's a lot of it. But also at the same time, as with many families, we had cats and dogs who we loved and doted on, and were part of the family. So there was that real split personality thing going on there, where some animals were just treated a little better than garbage, and others were given dignity and respect. And I think you just grow up thinking that that's normal too. You know, you've got this category of good animals and this category of don't care animals, and it all just becomes so normalised. But then in my early 20s, at that point, unemployment was very high in New Zealand. And what was that? I guess the 1990s, the early 1990s. My father worked at a slaughterhouse, a place called Pukuri, which was near the town I actually lived in. Wasn't Dunedin, it was Waimate at that stage. So I got a job because my father knew the guy who employed people down there. I got a job there, and I just couldn't get any other job around Waimate at that time. And it was not my dream job. I don't think it's anyone's dream job to work in a slaughterhouse, but it was like, oh, well, it's going to pay the bills. It's a job. I'll do it. And I rationalized it. I said, well, you know, come on, Carl, you're a meat eater. This is where it comes from. Somebody's got to do this work. And why not me? You know, why should I be exempt? So I kind of almost took a pride in owning that. You people, you just buy your food from a supermarket. I'm actually involved in the process. I own this. And I think a lot of hunters feel the same way. They intimately connected to their food choices and take a pride almost in that they're not squeamish. They can deal with this. I guess it's partly a sort of a masculine culture thing too, for males in particular. Although there are now a lot of women hunters, and there were certainly women at the slaughterhouse. But yeah, that's sort
and,
of.
And again, thing. I think it would be normal. It would be normal to be squeamish, wouldn't it? But again, we have to overcome it. Really,
that's what you're exactly right. That's absolutely it. Our natural state is to be squeamish and uncomfortable, and we have to override it. You're absolutely right. So now I got this job at the in New Zealand we call them freezing.
So we pay somebody at a slaughterhouse like you to remove us from the squeamishness, right? It's like, here, you do it so we don't have to be squeamish.
That's exactly it. Out of sight, out of mind, and you don't have to worry about those uncomfortable feelings and cognitive dissonance. You don't even connect. You don't even think about it. You just buy it off the supermarket shelf and don't think about where it came from. That's the average person. So now
here you were. You had reached a point where you couldn't do the trapping anymore. You know, that was too much for you. But then you started at a slaughterhouse working then. After that,
yes, and I had some reservations. I didn't really want to work there, but you know, it was a job, as I say, and there were not many jobs going, and it paid pretty well. For its time. So I worked on the place I was working on. It was a multi-story building, and I was on the top floor, and it was processing lambs and sheep. And they called it the mutton chain. It was like a production line chain. And my first job there was working on some people up on a stand would pull the intestines, the internal organs, out of the sheep and their heads. And I know this sounds gruesome, and it is gruesome. And they would put them down on the stainless steel trays that were on a conveyor belt sort of system. And five of us would be working on these, they're called the gut trays, processing the organs with knives and pulling the liver to bits, and the kidneys would go down one chute and the intestines down another chute and so on and so on. After I did that for 2 years, and then the third and fourth year I did a different job. A lot of the sheep's bodies that came down the chain had diseases or injuries, and we had to trim the carcasses up to get rid of all the damaged and diseased parts. And that was a bit of an eye-opener, because you'd get somewhat from certain farms, so they come through in a lot from a farm, and some of them would be riddled with disease, and others would come through where none of the sheep were had disease. So there was obviously different farmers had different regimes, and some of them seemed to care for their animals to some extent and some didn't. But also we had you'd get a whole lot would come through at once with broken ribs or even broken legs. It's like, what the hell is happening out there? You know, is this happening on the transport trucks, or is it happening at the farms, or what the hell's going on? And then you'd have some through, they'd come all through, a lot of them together, that have dog bites on them. And you had to trim those, but often it's like, oh my God, we've got six or seven in a row that have got dog bites. What the hell is happening with it? So whether that was in the pens before they went into the slaughterhouse, or at the farm, or loading them on or off the truck, I don't know. But what I did work out is that a lot of them, see, people have this idea, the humane myth, that they live a good life and they die a quick death. You know, what's the problem? Well, death's the problem. But the fact is, a lot of them don't have a good life, or at least not what people imagine. And that really brought that home to me. And also, they don't have a quick death always, too. I went down only on two occasions, and I watched the place where they... I don't know what the official job title was. I always called it the executioner. It was on the ground floor. They would come in through from the pens, through this hole in the wall, and they would be stunned, supposed to render them unconscious, as these electric paddles would come up and clamp the sheep's body, and some water would be sprayed on them to conduct the electricity, and they get a jolt passed through their body. And they would go rigid, and usually the paddles would be removed and they would be unconscious. And then they would slide down a wee chute thing, and somebody would cut their throat, and they would never wake up. And they just, that electric shock, and that's the last thing they knew in their life. But a lot of them didn't. A lot of them had to be shocked twice. and a lot of them slid down the chute when it seemed that they were unconscious, but then they would regain consciousness. So the executioner guy had to grab the sheep, put them back through a hole in the wall, and that individual sheep then had to go through the process all over again. Only this time it knew what was coming. Can you imagine how terrifying that must be? And I also know, if it was just logic tells me, if some of them were regaining consciousness just prior to having their throat cut, then presumably some of them were regaining consciousness just as or after they'd had their throat cut. And I certainly saw most of the animals will be shackled up on by their hind legs to go down the line, and most of them wouldn't. They might the body might twitch a wee bit, but some of them were kicking and convulsing while the blood poured out of their throats, and I think they were probably conscious. They probably regained consciousness. And what I'd always been told, oh, it's just nerves. No, no, that's just a nerve reaction. But hang on, some of them are doing that, but not many. Most of them aren't. No, I think they are conscious. So when somebody says, but they had a good life and die a quick death, you know, these are pastoral animals. They live in the open, on they're not, you know, not from a factory farm. No, they don't have great lives. I saw a lot of injuries and illness, and no, they don't always have clean, painless deaths. So it really is a myth. So I saw that. And I also saw somebody was off sick once, I think, and they need an extra person down, and they called it the beef house where they killed the cattle. And I watched them coming. That was pretty awful too. They didn't use electricity. They used a captive bolt gun fired in between their eyes to send this piece of steel into the cow's skull to mash up their brain a bit and render them unconscious.
That's what's considered humane, right? That's considered right, humane, right. The captive bolt gun, which is, yeah, as you said, you know.
But again, I was only there one day, and I only saw it, stood there and watched a few of the animals get killed. But even just in that short time, I saw one where it did not go well. He fired the captive bolt into the cow's skull, and blood was squirting out of this hole. The cow was fully conscious and bellowing and thrashing around. And I saw the guy frantically trying to reload the gun. It had a wee explosive charge bullet thing in it that fired the gun. Frantically trying to reload the gun. And then he was trying to get the captive bolt over the cow's head again so he could get the shot in the right place. It took quite a while. And finally, bang, the cow went down and was unconscious. But what really surprised me was that guy then turned around and saw me looking. And I don't know what look was on my face, but probably shock, but the guy looked at me and he looked really guilty and he looked really uncomfortable. Like, I just sort of thought somebody like that would get hardened to their job and not care, but he looked like that had unsettled him and upset him. Now, it's possible that the guy that normally did it was off sick and he was filling in, who knows. But all the same, what an ugly job to have to do. And I didn't feel any less responsible from working on other parts of the factory than the guy who was doing it. You kind of felt like, well, maybe he's the bad guy and the rest of us are okay. Well, that's not true. And even the people who eat the meat are as guilty as the guy who fires the captive bolt and pulls the knife across their throat, I believe. We're all just as guilty as
that guy. They make it possible. It's the demand that makes it all possible, because people pay for this.
Happens. That's right. If we stopped doing that, if we all went vegan, those jobs would cease to exist, and those people would have jobs in the horticulture industry. And I know I'd rather harvest carrots than kill sheep.
Absolutely, definitely, yeah. So, did you speak to that person then, who had that look on his face? Did you compare notes?
No, I just had to go and carry on with my job. But it stayed in my mind. I can still picture it in my mind. I can still see that, and it was not pretty. It was really ugly. I don't know how that must affect those guys who do it day in and day out. And it would be interesting.
From the slaughterhouses in the U.S., they have the highest turnover, practically maybe 100% turnover in a year. There's a lot of alcoholism, a lot of domestic violence. I mean,
surprise me. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, did you see that where you were, or was it more of
I was a bit of a loner. I didn't socialize much with my workmates. My friends in Waimate were not fellow meat workers, so we didn't really have those conversations, and nobody talked about it at the freezing works, even in the smoko. Well, smoko, that's a Kiwi word. It means morning and afternoon break. So it's smoker break or lunch break. Nobody ever talked about it. We talked about how boring and tedious the job was, which it was. I mean, any production line job is boring and tedious. That's what I hated about it the most. I soon became immune to the sort of animal suffering issues. You just have to live in denial. You have to sort of turn a blind eye and forget about it. But no, the tedium and the monotony were awful. And I think you do get a certain class of people. I don't mean to be awful, but a certain type of person works there because it's not a nice job. And if you can get a better job, you do. So you end up with these often young men who don't have any qualifications or skills, and young women. There were some women there too. They don't have qualifications to get a decent job, so they end up in these jobs, and which worries me because, you know, and same thing with the factory farms, that you get these angry young men with drinking problems and drug use and taking out their frustrations on the world, you know, on the animals. But there's some really, really good people, and I think this is something I'd like to make clear, because I don't see slaughterhouse workers or farmers as the enemy. I just see them as uninformed or misinformed, and meshed in a culture that accepts these things. It's hard to think outside the box when you are so enmeshed in it. And I met some really lovely people at the freezing works, and I know some really good farmers too. There's one or two unpleasant people I met, but most of them were reasonably decent people. And some of them were
freezing works. Freezing works is the name. What is freezing works? Is the name of the slaughterhouse, or that's what the slaughterhouse is called? Freezing works, or what?
It's a New Zealand name. It just means slaughterhouse. Because initially, and still, a lot of sheep and beef and things are exported around the world. So the animals are killed and then frozen and then transported overseas in the frozen form, so that's where it got the name freezing works, this frozen export industry.
Let me just mention, for people joining us, we are talking to Carl D. Scott, who is a founder of the Dunedin Vegan Society, and he's recounting his past life. And you say, you know, of course the people working there are nice people. They're just indoctrinated by culture. People who go buy bacon, you know, they don't realize that they're paying somebody. You know, they don't think, "Wow, I'm paying somebody to slit someone's throat right now." You know, and I guess I'm impatient with, like, how have they not awakened yet? Since I'm vegan for 32 years, why don't you? Well, and actually, how did you awaken? Because there you were at the slaughterhouse. Like, at a certain point, you had to say, "This isn't for me," or like, what was going on for you?
Mm-hmm. I didn't go vegan until I was 40. I'm 46 now. So this was my early 20s working at Pukuri Freezing Works. And I also did a very, like, 3 months, a short stint in a different freezing works, a place called Silverstream. So I guess in my mid-30s, or even my early 30s, I became conscious. And I put it down to the work of animal activists in New Zealand. One of our major groups, I guess the equivalent of your PETA, we have SAFE, Save Animals from Exploitation. So I saw advertisements and billboards and things, whatever, talking about factory farming. And I became conscious of that, and I became quite committed to only purchasing free-range products, like free-range pork products and eggs and chicken and so on. And if I went to a restaurant, I would not eat those products, because I just presumed they would come from factory farms. So there was a sort of a growing consciousness there, and I like to mention that it's probably the work of SAFE and other groups perhaps that woke me up to that. So I think it really demonstrates the importance of activism, because how do people find out about these things if nobody's spreading the word?
Yeah. So now, unfortunately, what's happened with so many groups, they've adopted these you know, support for cage-free eggs and grass-fed beef. You know, I mean, things have gotten compromised along the way to where, yes, it's almost like we need to reboot and say we need a vegan movement, you know, because, I mean, even as you mentioned PETA, PETA gave an award to Temple Grandin here for her construction and, you know, ideas pertaining to making slaughterhouses seemingly less cruel. So, you know, support for humane slaughter. I mean, all of this has come up with many of these groups, and it's really disconcerting because we really need that vegan message. Because, as you know, even though you were buying free range or grass fed or whatever, you eventually realize, like, wait a second, you know, it's more marketing than anything, really. You know, exactly. I mean,
that's right. Yeah, it came as a shock when I realized that free range was not all it was cracked up to be. But, you know, there is a move, and it's happening worldwide, and it's just beginning in New Zealand now, to move away from that sort of welfare reform type message to a more explicit veganism and rights message. And in fact, there's a group of us organizing, the Maori word, which is our indigenous people, Maori, the Maori word is hui, which means a gathering or a meeting. We're organizing a hui next year in our capital, which is Wellington. And so a lot of advocates and activists are coming together to talk about how do we start delivering a vegan and rights message. And so it's going to be a small meeting. It's not going to be all comers, just sort of certain key people. Just talk about how do we do this? How do we get this message out there in a way that will be taken seriously by the public and the politicians and the media and so on? There's a few people who have started doing experiments with it in New Zealand. Got a couple of groups doing this thing called the Earthlings Experience. They go out with laptops and tablets and show footage in public spaces, and then they talk to people who are interested and try to talk about veganism and rights and so on. We're seeing some slaughterhouse protests in New Zealand with more of a veganism and rights message. So the work has begun here to shift towards a more explicit vegan message. It's really encouraging. And it's continuing to shift.
Well, it cures everything, you know. So, I mean, it's in terms of course, the animals, as we said, if there weren't the consumer demand, that would end. But, you know, we're also told that going vegan is the only solution for climate change. World Bank climate specialists tell us since animal agriculture is the number one cause of climate change, responsible for at least 51% of all greenhouse gas emissions, these same climate specialists say it's the only solution. So I don't know if people are just, you know, looking around for, you know, some sort of cause or something to say, you know, saving the planet from climate change, I think, seems to be a concern of a lot of people. And if we are the only cure, you know, that's not a bad place. Then, of course, I would presume that people in New Zealand also suffer the diseases of animal consumption. I would imagine heart disease, cancer, stroke, diabetes, all of those prevalent.
Absolutely. Yeah, we're a very typical Western country in that respect, very much like the United States and the UK, Australia, mainland Europe, and so on. Yeah, very much the same.
Just like all humans, you know, it's any human that consumes that winds up with those diseases. There's no racial profiling or ethnic profiling when it comes
that's
to
right.
that.
Now,
and New Zealand is very big on dairy, isn't it? I mean, like, has that been the
it's a major export industry now. It's not so much the domestic market. It's being dairy products being sold to, I think, China is one of our largest markets. Not sure who else we sell to, but yeah, it's a big export industry, and it's doing terrible things to the environment. There's a lot of discussion in New Zealand at the moment about polluted waterways. A lot of our rivers and streams in this country, and this is, you know, we try and sell ourselves in the tourism industry as being clean and green New Zealand, and the dairy industry, among others, is destroying that image. A lot of our rivers are, and I'm not exaggerating, they are unsafe to swim in, let alone drink from. And we've had one of our government ministers has said, we're going to try and get our rivers and streams safe to wade in. And they think that's adequate. You know, when I was a child, you could swim in just about any river in the entire country. Now, most of them have warning signs, and it's dangerous to swim in a river. And that's just sickening to me. And yet, it's not even you know, people keep talking about dairy, it's the backbone of our economy. It's actually not. It's not as big a earner as they claim. And when you factor in the cleanup costs of all this environmental damage, there are no profits. It's not making any profit whatsoever. So a bunch of people, as usual, a bunch of wealthy, powerful people are increasing their wealth and power, and the rest of us are going to have to pay the cleanup cost. It's, you know, the dairy industry is a disaster for New Zealand, and people are starting to see that now, which is good.
A disaster for the world, really, and the cows and methane and climate change. I mean, yeah. So are there many vegans around you there in Dunedin?
Well, we had an interesting thing happen just recently. A friend of mine, Michael Hitchcock, organized a survey, him and some friends organized a nationwide survey of vegans, and it turned out that per head of population, Otago, which is the province where Dunedin is, New Zealand, like you guys, are divided up into states, we're divided up into provinces. Otago is the province with the highest number of vegans per head of population. But not just that, we had 3 to 4 times more than any other province. So Otago is way out in front as far as veganism goes. And we were really surprised by that. And we started asking ourselves, why? How come? You know, how's that? Well, and what we think is there's a lot of groups in Dunedin, animal advocacy groups, who are actively promoting veganism, not just, you know, ban cages or ban sow stalls or whatever, actively promoting veganism. So that's part of the equation. We also have one of our major industries, if you like, is Otago University. So there's a lot of young people, and as we know, a lot of young people are switching on to veganism. So that's part of the equation. And the rest of the story, we're not sure. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of good vegan food outlets in Dunedin. So it's actually quite easy to be vegan here. So those three things we think are why it's happening. And we love it that it's happening.
Yeah. So you have vegan restaurants there then too?
We've got one food outlet that's 100% vegan all the time. We've got another cafe that's just opened up. They're only doing coffee at the moment, but they're going to have food soon. They are 100% committed vegan. We've got another place called, that was Black Cat Cafe. So we've now got Naturally, another wee cafe and / restaurant that 100% vegetarian and I guess 90 to 95% vegan. They're almost there. We've got Potpourri, which is 100% vegetarian. And a few others are Modex and Formosa Delight that have a lot of vegan.
Vegetarian doesn't count though, because it's like, you know, the same as being with the meat eaters. You know, it's like, but all the reasons somebody would consider him or herself a vegetarian are the reasons to be vegan. So.
That's right. That's exactly you right. Know. And I think there is just that the lack of awareness around that at the moment. But I'm seeing that change too. We have a vegetarian society in New Zealand, and they're talking about veganism a lot now. And so it's even, you know, even the vegetarian society are heading in that direction, which is really encouraging.
That's happening a lot. So, yeah, it's good to see that. So we're just about out of time. Was there anything else you wanted to mention before we have to take off here, Carl?
Sure. No, one thing I'd just say to all your listeners is, It's a journey, this whole veganism and animal rights thing. And the first step is, as Gandhi said, be the change. And that is be vegan and commit to it and take it seriously. The second step, and this is how we're going to change the world, not just by being vegan, but the second step is promote change. That is to encourage others to go vegan. And that might be as simple as talking to family and workmates, or it might be getting involved with your vegan local vegan society and doing advocacy and outreach work. The third step.
How did you actually, Carl, go vegan yourself, though?
That is the weirdest story in the world ever, how someone went vegan. And nobody's ever come up with a better story yet. The short version is it was a spiritual experience. I was at a point in my life, I was looking for, a new direction in my life. What do I do with my life? And I believe, at least I certainly believed then, that I got some sort of spiritual guidance. The word vegan kept popping up on my radar, so to speak, and ended up, long story short, I had this profound dream. I was talking to somebody like the Buddha or Jesus or some holy person, and I said to them, can't remember what we're talking about, but the last thing I said to them was, I'm going to go vegan. And I burst into tears. I was still in the dream, burst into tears. And this feeling came over me as this just feels so right. And I woke up and was like, whoa. And it just, I just had this feeling that that's what I'm supposed to be doing. I don't know why, but that's what I'm supposed to be doing.
Because it is so right. It is so right.
It does feel right. It does feel right. You're absolutely right. Yeah. And when you do it, and because I thought veganism was a silly idea originally, but when I did it, it does feel right. And it's a funny way to phrase it, but it really does, doesn't it? It just feels right. It sits right.
Well, I couldn't live with myself if I weren't. You know, I mean, it's that's just so it feels right not to participate in. In oppressing others, especially when it tastes so good and the food is so good. So, you know, what's the problem? You know?
That's right, exactly. That's right.
Yeah. Okay, well, thank you, Carl, for being with us today. We really appreciate it. And you have certainly done the interesting journey. But, you know, most people don't start off vegan. We're not lucky enough to have parents with that kind of foresight. So, sure. You know, we've all made that change. We just need everybody else to join us, like, right now would be good.
That's right.
Thanks so much. Thanks for being with us today, Carl D. Scott, with the Dunedin Vegan Society, former slaughterhouse worker, now helping the world do the right thing. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
We will continue on Go Vegan Radio with Bob Linden at goveganradio.com. On Twitter, it's at Go Vegan Radio. Facebook, Go Vegan Radio with Bob Linden. It's Go Vegan Radio with Bob Linden at goveganradio.com, on Twitter at Go Vegan Radio, Facebook Go Vegan Radio with Bob Linden, and you can support this program with a tax-deductible donation. We do have a donate button at goveganradio.com, where hundreds of past shows are archived. Professor Francione is off this week, and I would like to thank HealthAid for its support. HealthAid Kombucha. Really, people are really liking HealthAid. So many delicious flavors. I can't even keep up with them. I just had a bottle of pomegranate. And HealthAid Kombucha is the only commercial kombucha fermented 100% in glass, flavored using only the highest quality ingredients, like cold-pressed juice from organic produce, and it's brewed in super small 2.5-gallon batches, naturally fermented and slightly naturally effervescent, never uses plastics or cheap metals in production, which prevents leaching. It's just quite delicious. So never pasteurized either, never added sugars. HealthAid Kombucha, delicious, we love it. And also want you to know that there is only one vegan resort in the USA. One vegan resort, and that's the Stanford Inn on the Mendocino coast in California. And check it out. Go to StanfordInn.com. And a lot going on there. You can do a lot or do nothing. You can bike and canoe. And there's a whole health and wellness program. You can do art. And the famous Ravens restaurant is there. Vegan restaurant. And the book is out from the owners of the Stanford Inn. Dining at the Ravens, Jeff and Joan Stanford. That book is available. Go to stanfordinn.com. Check out the rooms. Companion animals are welcome. You'll have a great time at the only vegan resort in America. You know, so before, when I was saying that, well...
The fan
is on, sorry. Have to remember to turn off the fan in our climate-changed, globally warmed pseudo-studio. So, okay. Where was I? Saying before, now, of course, this program is on now for over 15 years, practically 15 and a half years. Inexplicably, huh? Leading the way. We knew eventually it would catch on. You know, the vegan thing would catch on. It is catching on in such a big way now, actually. We could just feel it when we were at the World Vegan Summit and Expo, but I see a piece here in Seeker.com saying that stereotyped as pretentious hippies, wait a second, who are you calling a pretentious hippie, even though I was at Woodstock? So it says here, stereotyped as pretentious hippies, vegans have been the target of much ridicule for decades. But, as it turns out, those who choose a diet entirely free of animal products might get the last laugh. Well, of course. Veganism is currently on the rise in many Western countries, it says here, exactly says that, particularly for those under the age of 34, and the new converts are singing its praises. Come on, join us, okay? Hallelujah. It says that Berlin is considered the vegan capital of Europe, with around 80,000 vegans, 10% of the total number of vegans in Germany, according to the news agency France 24. Berlin is at the forefront of a vegan movement happening all over Europe, with Paris and London not far behind. So the city has 60 vegan restaurants to choose from, it says here, which offers far exceeding the underwhelming salad that might come to mind when picturing a typical vegan meal, though I like salad a lot. Salads can be overwhelmingly wonderful too, but okay, I get the point. And it says there are soy ice cream shops galore, and even a 100% vegan pizzeria, and where? There was something, I think, in The Guardian. Is that what I was looking for? Oh, yeah. So, in The Guardian, it also says, the rise of vegan teenagers. More people are into it because of Instagram. And so, apparently, in the UK, big rise, veganism on the rise. It says veganism, I guess I said that because I must have read it somewhere. So right here in The Guardian, it says, veganism is on the rise. It says, in 2006, 150,000 people in the UK opted for a plant-based diet. I presume they mean vegan. And it says, today, 542,000 people do. That's a 350% increase since 2006. In the vegan population in the UK. It says the movement is driven by the young. Close to half of all vegans are aged 15 to 34. That's 42%, compared with just 14% who are over 65. So, it says when The Guardian asked people about being vegan, 67% of the 474 who replied were under 34, and more than one-sixth were teenagers. And so that's the good news. So no reason to wait, and it's all being embraced by the millennials. So we're happening. We are happening. So it's time for you to go vegan if you haven't gone vegan yet. Please join us and help us save the world and the animals and your family. Okay, I think that will just about do it for this week's program. Ben has to leave. and he's in the control room, and if he leaves, we're out of control. So we're done for tonight, and thank you for listening, and we will be back with you next week. And as always, programs are archived at goveganradio.com.